Welcome to the Oxford Education Deanery podcast. In this series, we explore the latest research from the Department of Education at the University of Oxford and discuss the real-world implications for teachers, parents, and policymakers. Each podcast is accompanied by a Deanery Digest, a short, plain language summary of the research, which can be downloaded from our website.
Hello, it's Laura Mulway here from the Oxford Education Deanery. Today, I'm here with Dr. Priya Tarr. And we're going to be talking about her research in the area of kinship caring, and particularly kinship carers from Black and Asian communities. Priya, before we begin, could you say just a little bit more about yourself and about where this research theme came from?
Sure. Thanks, Laura. So I am a researcher at the Rees Centre, and our work is predominantly with children, with a social worker. So that could be foster care, kinship care, adoption, care experience young people. And this actually came via a call from Kinship, the charity. They wanted a researcher or a team to come in and research experiences of Black and Asian kinship carers. And that was because in the research that's predominantly been done in this area, it's usually with white families. And so they really wanted to capture experiences of minority ethnic communities. And so just this was really just a start in that direction. So just an exploratory study.
Great. Thank you. And just listening to you there, I realise we should probably address, just in case some of our listeners are not familiar, exactly what the term kinship care covers.
Yeah. I was going to start with that because as we found, actually, the term kinship care isn't very well known. But yeah, for our listeners, kinship care is where a child is cared for by a family member. So where their own parents are unable to care for them, either a family member, and sometimes it could be a family friend, will step in and look after that child. And there are different types of kinship care. So we've got formal kinship care, which is where there's a legal order in place. So the carers will have parental responsibility. They can make those decisions that a parent might make for the child. There are also foster carer kinship carers. So these are known as kinship foster carers, connected carers, or family and friends carers. And they take a foster care role. So they're overseen by the local authority, and the local authority will have that parental responsibility. But they might delegate some of those responsibilities to the foster carers. So that is where, it's more of a foster carer role, but it's with someone within the family. And then you have informal carers who are not generally known to services. They've agreed with the parent that they will take on the care of the child. They don't have parental responsibility, and they often won't have any input from services, therefore won't have that support.
Oh, I see. It's actually quite a complex landscape, isn't
it? Yeah.
And so you wanted to find out more about these kinds of carers and the support that they need and their experiences. What exactly did you do?
Okay, so just to give some context, first of all, of the around 120,000 children currently in kinship care, about a fifth of those are cared for by minority ethnic carers.
Right.
But the research doesn't reflect those experiences. So it was really important that we understood a bit more about what those experiences look like, what potential barriers might look like, and what potential challenges they face. So in terms of the study, like I said, it was a very exploratory study. So we just wanted to get a snapshot to start off with of the experiences that our Black and Asian kinship carers were having. So what we did was, along with three peer researchers who were kinship carers themselves but had some research experience, we basically went out and tried to share information about the study and recruit carers to the study. So we'd aimed to recruit 40 kinship carers. We ideally wanted 50% from the Black community, 50% from the Asian community, and we also wanted an equal split of informal and formal carers. We kind of went out and recruited via community groups, used social media. We also used our own contacts. So peer researchers had their own networks. I personally had my own network of people as well that we kind of shared information about the study with. But we quickly realised that it wasn't that easy. One reason was because the term kinship care is not very well known amongst some communities. So it was very difficult to kind of start recruiting to a study where actually the basis of the study was really alien to a lot of the people that we were talking to. So I think a lot more preparation needed to be done with those communities before actually going out and recruiting. And we hadn't realized that, we hadn't anticipated it. So we also then engaged with Kinship Charity, who had funded the study via KPMG Foundation, to sort of use their databases, their networks, and share research that way as well to try and kind of increase the numbers. So that helped. And in the end, we had 38 carers who took part. One withdrew before we actually started doing the analysis. So the data that we talk about today is of 37 kinship carers, majority of who were from the Black Caribbean community. And I would say that's because there are established kinship groups within that community. One of our peer researchers co-founded Families in Harmony that predominantly works with Black Caribbean, but also Black African and some Asian families. But yes, I think within the Black Caribbean community, actually the idea of kinship and those peer support groups are already quite well established compared to families with Black African backgrounds. So
sorry to interrupt you.
No,
I was just thinking that's very interesting. And do you think that therefore your study findings relate to a group who are relatively well connected and aware of support compared to others that may be out there who were not included in the study, partly due to those barriers to access?
Yes, definitely. So particularly with the informal group, we ended up with 4 out of 37 that were informal carers. And I'll talk about sort of reasons why that might be. And like I said, yes, the Black Caribbean community, we had carers from that community. Majority of the carers that took part were from that community and so had already built support networks with other kinship carers from the same community. So I think we did have people taking part that perhaps had access to support or knowledge about kinship care. But even so, it's quite interesting in terms of what they told us about their experiences.
Yes, and we will get to that in a moment. I have just one more question for you about how you went about then gathering perspectives.
So we used a combination of a structured interview. So we wanted to make sure we tried to cover every aspect of being a kinship carer from sort of before they became a carer, you know, what were their lives like, to actually becoming a carer, challenges that they faced, and also how they saw their future as a carer. So we wanted to try and talk about everything, which was challenging. But alongside that, we also used some standardized assessments. So we wanted to understand a bit more about the health and well-being of kinship carers. We wanted to understand more about the stress they were under, and also find out a bit more about the support that they got. So we used standardized assessments to do that, as it's quite a quick way of getting an idea of those things. Having said that, they were around 2 hours of carer's time. Yeah.
Which implies there was a lot to say.
Yes. I mean, on average, I would say 2 hours, some were longer. So yeah, people had a lot to say. And I guess for a lot of carers, it was the first opportunity that they got to talk about their experiences and really stop and reflect. Most of them had just sort of taken on that responsibility and were just living day to day.
Yes, it's a very busy role. Right, so let's move into the really interesting bit then, mm-hmm. which is, what did they say?
Yes, there was a lot, so I will try and keep it brief. I suppose in the first instance, they talked about sort of becoming kinship carers. In this research, we found it was grandmothers and aunts that were predominantly caring for children within their family, and the age range was between 26 and 71. So quite different to what we're used to seeing. So therefore, when we talked to them about how they became a kinship carer, they were often in very different stages of their life. So yes, heading to retirement, some were just starting their own families. We had a carer who was planning to emigrate, and so, you know, different stages of life. And then, you know, this, I suppose, offer or sense of responsibility comes about and things change, and their lives did change quite drastically. Often, whether it was the parent or services that were coming to these carers, there wasn't much time to make a choice. It was almost like you need to decide now, otherwise this child will be going into care. And so...
Wow, that's a huge pressure.
Yeah, yeah. So it felt very much like an ultimatum for a lot of carers. They felt like they weren't given the options. They weren't sure what the options were. So I mentioned at the beginning, some carers might have taken the kinship foster carer role, but actually at that point, they were just asked to either take care of the child or that child would be put into care. And some carers were also, I'll use the word threatened, but it might be too strong, but I'm not sure if it is, that the child would be adopted.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Right. So this is actually a real moment of stress and, you know, in terms of how well informed these carers were, it doesn't sound like they necessarily had the full picture of options available to them.
No, they didn't. And a lot of them felt that the options that were presented, and I say options, it was usually just one, were the things that perhaps for children's services was more beneficial to them than to the carers and to the child. And often that was around finances and kind of keeping costs low. So yeah, I think carers just obviously their main concern was keeping the child safe, making sure the child stayed within the family, and where there were siblings involved, trying to keep those siblings together. So they didn't really consider what it meant for them, for their families, for their employment, for finances. They just kind of had to make that decision there and then without thinking through the consequences.
Right. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. And so that was the section about how people became kinship carers, how they ended up in this position.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Did you also find out a little bit more about what their day-to-day lives were then like and how things had changed for them?
Yes. So a lot of our carers obviously just had to take responsibility for now another member of their family. You know, some of them had experience of looking after children, some didn't. You know, some were grandparents who obviously had raised their children and were kind of heading towards retirement, so weren't really ready for that. And I think the kind of day-to-day struggles that they talked about were the impact on finances, the challenges in now having to look after another person and the impact on their employment. So kinship care isn't recognised legally by employers yet, and that's something that kinship are working on changing. So where you might have, you know, maternity leave, adoption leave, we don't have that for kinship. So often overnight, carers are taking on give care of another child, but don't have the time to kind of work out how that's going to look practically. So kinship carers are having to leave work, reduce their hours, try and find ways of managing employment around, you know, caring for the child. So they were quite immediate challenges. I suppose longer term for the child themselves, the additional needs of that child as they got older, additional needs that kind of became more obvious as the child had sort of been with the carer for a longer amount of time. So these could be mental health needs. They might be additional learning needs. These weren't evident at the time of the child coming to live with carers. So we've got to remember some of these carers were very involved in children's lives before they came to live with them. Some were not. So it's really difficult for them to anticipate what those needs might be as the child got older. So having access to therapy, access to getting the child assessed, identify what those needs were and how they might help the child. They were all challenges that then they realised they had to kind of try to overcome, and they were the challenges that they were facing. So it's a lot of care for additional needs, finances, space in the house, having enough room for another person living there. So yeah, quite a lot of big challenges. And I think for them, they didn't have the support, and that was one of the key things, is that at the beginning they were almost given no options, but then they felt like actually services, especially if a legal order had been put in place almost at that point, and one grandparent said the umbilical cord was cut at that point, where services were like, right, your responsibility now, and that was it. After that, no monitoring of the child, which carers were quite concerned about. So yeah, they felt abandoned.
I'm really sorry to hear about all of these complex things that people are navigating with very little. You mentioned one possible implication or recommendation from your research, which was to begin to recognize that the taking on of kinship care has a similar impact to adopting or indeed having your own biological child and that period of adjustment that's required. And so there's a suggestion here that perhaps there should be some statutory right to leave. Are there any other, I suppose, implications of your work for policy or for children's services?
Yeah, so I think similarly, foster carers and children in foster care will be prioritised for if there's therapeutic support they need, they are prioritised and they are given help to access that support. Kinship children are not. Carers feel that they should have access to similar things. That could be some financial support, but it would also be that support in accessing things that the child might need to help them to, you know, reach their full potential. And obviously with this group, we wanted to explore ethnicity and how they felt that that had an impact in terms of coming from a Black or Asian background. What does that mean? Carers were mixed in their responses. They felt that some felt that ethnicity didn't necessarily play a part, and others felt quite strongly that, you know, there were quite racist systems in place that were almost preventing them from caring for their children in the way that they would want to. And so that was something we kind of explored a bit more with families. There was some real evidence of systemic racism and examples such as a Black aunt who had a young teenage nephew living with her, and they were living in a one-bedroom flat on a waiting list for about 7 years to get a bigger property. And the only things that were offered to them were things in high-rise buildings and in certain areas that she didn't think was safe for her nephew. And this is to do with, you know, knife crime, gangs. And she felt that services didn't quite understand why she kept refusing certain things that they were offering, and they hadn't quite grasped how dangerous it might be for actually a young Black boy to be placed in an area, in certain areas and in certain types of accommodation. That was something she felt there was a disconnect there. We had another family, an Asian family, grandparents whose grandchildren were actually taken away from them. And so they had to spend sort of the 2 years they were trying to get the grandchildren back, they had to spend seeing their grandchildren in a contact centre. So in order to kind of have that link with their grandchildren and I suppose treat their grandchildren, they would take home-cooked food for the grandchildren to eat. It was food that the grandchildren loved when they lived with their grandparents, and they felt it was a way to keep them connected because they hadn't been placed with an Asian foster carer. And so they wanted to sort of make sure they still could eat the food that they loved and feel connected to the grandparents. And the grandparents were stopped from bringing their food because the social worker said that the children were looking forward to the food too much and weren't interacting enough with the grandparents. So something very simple, which could have been, I suppose, you know, overcome by just talking to the grandparents and to really understand that significance of the food, was just not even mentioned. You know, they didn't even think to ask them what the relevance was that.
Yeah. That really demonstrates a complete lack of cultural sensitivity, doesn't
exactly.
it, on the part of the social workers who were coordinating that interaction.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think that's where kind of our other recommendation around improved social worker education, training and practice. And it is around that cultural sensitivity, yes, and humility. So if you don't know or if you're not sure about why certain families are doing certain things, ask them and try and find out more. I don't think there's an expectation that every social worker is going to know everything about every culture. But it's, I think, more about understanding that you can ask and try to understand where that family is coming from and what the significance of certain things are for those families. Another assumption that was made by a lot of social workers and services was that, okay, Black and Asian families tend to come from extended networks, they have extended families, and as a result, they actually have a lot of support. So they don't really need services to come in and support them. Whereas our families were saying that the extended network is very different nowadays. It doesn't look the way that it might have looked in the past. And actually, when you have an extended family, you have extended responsibilities as well. So it doesn't quite work in the way that is assumed by services.
So these are really important learnings, actually,
yeah,
for services that are working with any family.
Exactly. Yes.
Actually.
So
that's really interesting. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you would like to raise that really comes out of your report that you think anybody out there who is working perhaps with families who are becoming kinship carers or a kinship carer in the process of taking on that responsibility?
Yeah, I think it's difficult because with people that are working with kinship carers, they are constrained, I suppose, by what they can offer. But from what the carers were telling us, just having more information at that point where they are, you know, having to make a really big decision, being informed was really key for them. And this, you know, it could just be simply signposting them somewhere that can offer them more support or information if that local authority isn't equipped to do it, because not all local authorities will have a specific like named person for kinship care or a specific group, a team for kinship care. We know kinship charities themselves, you know, have a really good range of support that they offer. So even signposting to somewhere like Kinship would be really useful and helpful. And for kinship carers themselves, what our kinship carers told us was that the peer support was really invaluable. So where they were able to find similar, you know, people in similar situations, actually it just helps them feel less alone. And also a really good source of information as well. So trying to access or find someone that understands what you're going through is always really helpful. But I think the difficulty is there aren't necessarily, you know, that many groups around that can do that. But again, Kinship Charity is sort of campaigning and working to ensure that peer research is available, peer support is available, and ensure that there are policy changes to practice that will help kinship carers. So they're always working for that, but I would always say first port of call for kinship carers would be that is invaluable at the beginning.
Great. Well, we will make sure that the link to that website is available in the show notes. Brilliant. For this episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, Priya.
Thank you.
Good luck with whatever comes next in your research.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Oxford Education Deanery podcast. To find out more about the research featured in today's episode and everything else the Deanery has to offer, visit our website and sign up to our newsletter. You'll find the links in the show notes.